Maine's June primary is drawing near, and today we bring you another in our series of Your Vote 2018 interviews with the candidates vying for their party's nominations in the race for governor and 2nd District congressional seat. In this series, we'll hear from all 14 primary candidates on a range of key issues. We'll also find out why each believes that they're the best choice to represent their party in the general election this fall. If you miss either of our candidate interviews in this hour, you can hear all 14 conversations at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You can also learn more about each of the candidates and see their positions broken down on an easy-to-use issues grid near the top of our Your Vote 2018 page. Today, we'll hear from two gubernatorial hopefuls, Democrat Adam Cody and Republican Ken Fredette. Cody is an attorney with Drummond Woodsum, a member of the Maine Army National Guard for more than 20 years. He's a decorated combat veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan who also served in Bosnia. Cody is co-founder and CEO of Thermal Energy Storage of Maine. He served on the Sanford School Committee and on the board of the Midcoast Regional Development Authority. In 2008, he lost a race for Maine's 1st District congressional seat to Shelley Pingree. Cody earned a bachelor's degree from Colby College and a law degree from the University of Maine School of Law. He told Steve Missler that Maine will need to focus on three key areas if it's to see growth over the next 10 years.
Infrastructure, broadband being the most important. You can't sell blueberries outside of Washington County if you don't have that. We have one of the worst connections in the country. Workforce training. I haven't been to a business yet in Maine that isn't having problems with recruiting, retention, or attrition management. It's harder to find a plumber, electrician, or finished carpenter in this state than it is to find a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And we've got to train a workforce that will prepare us for the needs from today. And lastly, I want to see us focus on our competitive advantages, finding the next generation of forest products, whether it's cross-laminated timber, bio-based plastics, whether it's in renewable energy, which I have a particular background and interest in. It's agriculture, it's aquaculture, healthcare industry. We need to focus on a growth plan to increase our tax base and grow our economy.
You've kind of alluded to this in your response, but what do you think is the biggest challenge facing the state? And what do you think you could do as governor to fix it?
Well, the biggest challenges are we're last in New England, one of the last in the country on jobs, income, and economic growth. We have the oldest population in the country, and we're one of only a couple states where our population isn't growing. So if we're going to face this demographic cliff of people retiring and getting older, we have to have a growth strategy. We have to be able to create an economy where young people want to be. They want to be innovators, entrepreneurs, and grow. It's got to be a growth plan.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that? What do you propose to do that?
If we're going to invest in education, healthcare, and the environment, we've got to grow. So I see it in three categories. The first is infrastructure, broadband being the most important. The second is workforce training. And the third is our competitive advantages. And with a vision of what this state can look like 10 years from now, I want to see the kids getting out of Jay and Millinocket and Sanford High, where I went to school. They want to be an innovator, an entrepreneur. They don't have that aspirational gap that exists now where they feel as though they got to go someplace else to do it. I think if we focus on those three things, we can create that cultural shift that's going to be needed to do that.
Polls continue to show that jobs are the biggest concern for voters in the state. You've kind of answered this question, but I mean, what else can you do to grow the economy besides broadband, besides, you know, looking at ways to grow the forest economy and healthcare? Is there any other things on the table for you?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, right? Everyone says we need jobs, and then other people say, well, unemployment is low. I think that's just a recognition of the fact that we're underemployed, that we're not. We're last in jobs, income, and economic growth. So it has to be a strategy that we can afford, that's targeted, that's focused, and that's why it has to be on those three categories: infrastructure, workforce training, and competitive advantages. Okay. And renewable energy, I should say, as one of those competitive advantages, is something that's of particular interest to me.
As you know, Mainers will be using ranked choice voting in this primary election. Assuming that you will rank yourself as the top choice, how are you going to rank the other candidates?
Well, I've been joking with people that if they're confused about it, you start in the top left and you just diagonally go down because I'm alphabetical, right? I haven't decided, to be honest with you, and I know a lot of folks are talking about the ranked choice and they want my thoughts on it. I support the will of the voters, and I supported ranked choice voting. Right now, I'm not doing anything differently that I would have done, because when I decided to run, I didn't know who else was going to run. I just knew that I was in it.
Nationally, Maine ranks relatively low in its rate of gun violence, but nearly half of domestic violence homicide in the state involve guns. Should Maine's gun laws be changed, and if so, how?
Well, I'll tell you, I feel quite confident in saying I know more about firearms than anybody on either side of the aisle. I grew up hunting. I own guns. My grandfather was a Maine guide. And I've trained hundreds of soldiers in this in the National Guard. I had 3 combat tours in Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. But I'll also say I have 5 kids in our schools here in Maine on doing active shooter drills. And to say that it can't happen here, I think is scary, that we're not thinking ahead and seeing this is happening everywhere. So I do believe we need to address it, and I think we can do it in a way that respects our heritage of hunting and those folks that like to have firearms. My key principles are these. I think if you're a danger to yourself or others, you shouldn't be having a firearm. So that means universal background checks. I think if you're going to be carrying a firearm, you need to demonstrate you know how to use it. It's just basic safety awareness. And I think we need to start looking at the capabilities of some of these firearms with things like bump stocks and high capacity magazines. And then on a broader level, we need to have a real discussion about, I think half these kids think they're in a video game when they're doing this. We need to talk about parents and guardians and responsibility, the hollowing out of our healthcare system and our mental health care system, and being able to identify some of these people in advance so we can help treat them. What I would do as soon as I became governor would bring key stakeholders together, including people from the sportsman field, the mental health care, the schools. With those issues as a framework, I think we could come up with a comprehensive plan that would satisfy people. The thing that I would bring to the table is a sense of credibility, because I do understand firearms better than anybody in this race, and I think I could provide some real leadership on it.
Next topic is about Maine's low unemployment rate. It ranks 44th nationally in median household income, but we have people that aren't making a lot of money. How can we help workers earn more?
We have a low unemployment rate because our population isn't growing. So we have the oldest population in the country and a stagnant one. We're last in New England on jobs, income, and economic growth. If we're going to really grow our economy here in Maine, we have got to create a bit of a transformational shift where young people get out of school and they want to stay here. Others from across the country and internationally, I see the state of Maine as being the type of place where young innovators, entrepreneurs want to start businesses, they want to grow our existing businesses, and we have to have a growth strategy. And that's why I talk over and over and over again about infrastructure, broadband being the most important, workforce training, and focusing on our competitive advantages. I think if we do those 3 things and do them well, we will have an entirely different situation in the state of Maine 10 years from now when my oldest daughter gets out of school.
This was right in your wheelhouse, I think. Maine is one of the more expensive states for electricity customers, although it's the lowest in New England. As governor, what would you do to try to lower power costs?
You look at any state in the country that has the lowest electricity costs, but often the lowest taxes because they have a broad tax base, a common denominator is that they produce their own power. They control their own destiny. And a lot of them are sort of the old economy, whether it's oil or coal or, you know, natural gas. But it's also the Tennessee Valley Authority. Their governments recognize locally that there was a benefit in controlling their own destiny. So the next generation of that power will be renewables, and Maine could be a great leader in that. So I think the long-term strategy is to produce our own power and be a provider of power regionally, as well as being a global leader in the technologies that come out of it, the storage technologies, the demand response technologies. All of these types of things lead to real jobs that we need. In the short term, to bring down electricity costs, we have the ability to do that now with what's called time of use metering, where through the smart meters and other things that people have in their homes and the back end that the utilities have, they can charge a lower rate at night or early in the morning. And Mainers being Mainers, I know that if they were offered a third of the price for electricity for that they use after 8 o'clock at night or before 7 in the morning, I know we would be turning our washer and dryer on then with 5 kids, and we go through a lot of that. But these are some smart things we can do early to reduce electricity costs, but also get people introduced to the larger concept of sort of the smart house, the next generation of this is where the world is going. Mm-hmm. There are little old ladies in Portugal purchasing power online at the lowest price. We're not doing that here. We're caught in an old model in a market where we can really be leaders. Mm-hmm. We could be global leaders in this.
And these technologies that you're talking about, would those be affordable for most Mainers? We're not a rich state, as you know.
Of course. The time of use metering that I'm talking about, everybody already, 97% of Mainers have a smart meter on the house right now. Mm-hmm. The utilities asked for them a few years ago. We paid for them already. We haven't been seeing any benefits from them. They haven't been using them for what they're capable of doing. And they said, you can look it up, 2011, I believe, or it was 2012, they were asking for these smart meters. They got them. Now let's use them.
Mm-hmm. I know you've been talking about this on the campaign trail a lot, about attracting businesses to the state. Some believe that tax incentive programs like Pine Tree Zones are the way to do that. Do you find that those programs are effective economic development tools, or are they, as some people will characterize them, corporate welfare?
They're not all the same. I will say that. I would like to see, when we do tax incentives, that there are real clear benefits that are coming to the state. Things that are called clawback provisions. In other words, if you're going to say to a business, you need to use this to invest in infrastructure improvements or to commit to have so many employees that will generate the revenue, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the types of incentives where, when I see those and it looks like a really viable option, it makes sense. Otherwise, sometimes they are corporate welfare. So I wouldn't answer the same. I would have to see each one individually. You know, we need a cultural shift here in this state. We've got this pattern of saying we've never done it that way before, whatever it is. You can go to any town meeting in the state and you hear some version of that being said. And lastly, we need to create more of a welcoming state. I get I don't know if I kick out of it, but this whole people being from away thing. Right. I was born and raised in Maine. Love the state. Absolutely. My wife's from Columbia. She's been here over 20 years. People still say you're from away. It's like, at what point do you become a Mainer? You know, right. I mean, just culturally, I think we've got to create more of an environment where people want to be. And that's where businesses want to be. They want to grow. They want employees that are focused and forward looking. And there's a sense of momentum mm-hmm. in the state. And we haven't had a sense of momentum. We haven't had a plan on what we're going to look like when my kids are growing up. And we need that.
On those economic development tools, what I've noticed in the legislature, every time there's a review of, say, Pine Tree Zones, for example, and, you know, OPEGA does a review and they come out and they say, well, we really can't tell if this thing is working. There's always a pushback from a combination of the business community and this current administration that maybe those clawbacks or those metrics that you're talking about may not be – that aren't in the best interest of – I don't know, economic development. What would you say to that?
I would say it. I am not coming into this with an axe to grind or a view that all things are created equal. I think sometimes when you come in with a preconceived agenda that everything for business is good, or, you know, everything for business is suspicious, I'm coming in for it focused on what I think our state should look like, can look like 10 or 15 years from now. Right now, that means anytime, and this gets back to sort of my view of leadership. I think anytime you're a leader and you come into an organization, you need to find what the biggest needs are. Right now, the biggest needs in Maine are to grow our economy and create some growth. So there are different ways and different policies that you can look at that. I've talked about my three core principles on how to do that. But with respect to things like tax incentives and others, it's depending on – it's doing due diligence on the business. It's finding out their commitment in other places, their commitment here. Who are their backers? So I guess, Steve, it depends on the situation. Mm-hmm. You're not going to see me coming in and saying all of these tax incentives are great, or that I'll never consider them.
Let's shift a little bit to Maine's welfare system, which over the past 7.5 years has been the subject of a lot of really hotly contested policy debates. What do you think about Maine's welfare system? Is it falling short? Is it working? Is it helping people get out of poverty?
My core beliefs on it are that we need to have a viable social welfare program that is going to be a leg up for people. Now, this has become, in my mind, a very toxic, a very divisive issue, primarily, in my view, because we've had folks running for office without a vision on how to grow this state, but a much clearer way of how to target and blame other folks. And I've seen this happen throughout the country, throughout the world. You get people running and saying the reason your life is bad is because of that person and that person. I don't think, and I certainly don't support, and I don't know anybody that supports somebody, some lazy person sitting on a couch playing video games and living off the government. I don't think that makes sense at all. So I think it needs to be a leg up. It needs to be a smart approach. I think we need to stop vilifying people that need some assistance and need some help. I would crack down on anybody that is trying to take advantage of the system, but we need to have a viable system, and it needs to be a generational focus. A couple generations, sometimes it takes people to get out of poverty. You're seeing it in the worst parts. It's like, it's become sort of a culture, and we need to get people into a work culture where they're contributing and they want to give back. And I believe the vast majority of people that are on assistance for a short time have that mentality, and they need to work towards it.
I know you're a supporter of the Medicaid expansion that voters approved last year. There's some question about how it should be funded, at least the state side mm-hmm. cost. Do you have any ideas about that? Should it come from the rainy day fund, or should it be a more sustainable source? Should it just be in the budget?
This is another thing that I think is a debate that's happening in Augusta that we just need to look nationwide to find the answers, because 37 states have already accepted Medicaid expansion funding, 17 of which have Republican governors. So this is not a partisan issue nationwide. You look at the independent studies that have been done on those 37 states, the return for every dollar that's coming into those states back into their economy has been between $1.35 and $1.85. In other words, in every state in the country, it has paid for itself. And here we are mired in gridlock because we're talking about an issue that hasn't happened in 37 states that have accepted it. But it gets back to the toxicity that's existing right now in Augusta, in my mind, the lack of leadership and the lack of a clear vision. I would absolutely accept Medicaid expansion funding in a state where we have the oldest population, a massive opioid crisis going on. This is something we really need right now.
Does the state pay its fair share of local education costs? Do local districts, should they get more money? Is more local education money the answer to improving our education outcomes?
I have experienced this in Sanford. I was on the school committee when Governor LePage cut revenue sharing. We had a $30 million budget. We lost over $1 million in a community where 70% of our kids are on free and reduced lunch in most of our schools. We're a very low-income community. So how we could we wouldn't hire replacements for teachers that had retired. We had to cut junior high and freshman sports, arts programs. And at a time when the state was coming down with this proficiency-based learning requirement, we couldn't afford to send our educators for professional education. It affected us greatly. So I strongly support increasing funding for education, particularly if you remember I was saying one of our biggest issues is workforce training. If we're not going to produce the future workers for our state in a real base level, we're not going to fund it the way to turn out the right folks, then we'll continue to be mired in these same problems.
What about, you mentioned teachers One thing the state is experiencing right now is a teacher shortage, particularly in rural areas. How do we incent more teachers to come work here?
Stop requiring them to have a bake sale for every pencil they have to buy. I come from a family of teachers. My dad taught at Sanford High for 30 years, and my wife's a teacher, Spanish teacher, and my aunt. It's sort of like the family profession, so I know quite a bit about this, even though I haven't been a teacher myself. Yes, funding is an important piece of it. Professional opportunity is an important piece to it. Feeling that you're a valued member at a real base level is very important. A big part of it comes down to funding, and stop messing around with them with all of these, you know, the latest unfunded mandate that comes down from the state. It's like, honestly, you know, we've got a new mandate that comes down constantly. Just let the teachers teach.
Mm-hmm. There's been a spike in number of referendums and ballot initiatives that Mainers have had to consider over the years. There's a lot of reasons for that. But now what we're seeing in the legislature is a pushback. And part of it is from Republicans, but there's certainly some angst among Democrats that maybe the referendum process is either not working the way it was intended, or that it's being used by special interest groups to push policies that may or may not be, in the legislators' view, in the best interests of the state. Do you think it's working? And if not, how would you change it?
I think it's a byproduct of the dysfunction that's happening in Augusta right now. When people aren't getting the job done by funding education, therefore towns are seeing property taxes increase. When the legislature isn't accepting Medicaid expansion funding in a state that is being hit with an opioid crisis, and home health care workers they're getting paid the same as somebody that works at a, you know, fast food restaurant. And you see the frustration in people, and that is their avenue and that is their way to do it. So I support the referendum process. It is part of it's been part of our history. Now, what is odd is that in the past in Maine, it had always been sacrosanct that you pass a referendum and the legislature says, oh, all right, we get a slap on the wrist that we didn't get anything done. The governor steps forward and does it. It started with the Land for Maine's Future bond, and then some of these other ones that happen where the governor and then the legislature, they just said, you know what, we're not going to do that. And that just further adds to people feeling, rightfully in my mind, that they're not being heard, they're not being listened to.
It seems as though that there's this propensity to base govern. And there's a working theory that the country is just so polarized that it's best for elected officials to keep their supporters happy and loyal rather than agree to compromise or build coalitions. Is that theory true? Do you believe that's happening? And what do you do to fix it?
I think that in this point in our country's history, none of us know if we're trending towards this talk show mentality, idiocracy, authoritarianism, divisive, whatever you want to call it, or if it's going to be viewed as an anomaly. Like, that was a really terrible time. People weren't communicating, and we got past it. I think a lot of this will be decided in this election cycle. Electing people who are coming in without an axe to grind, but a focus on getting something done. We need to start electing people like that, a sense of humility, a sense of service, a sense of bringing people together, but also a view of what we can look like.
In the past, there have been campaigns that focus a lot on transparency in government. Telling people what you're up to is not necessarily the priority of some elected officials. How important is it to you?
That's very important. It's very important. And again, I think that is a byproduct of the trend we're going into in society of you hear the fake news or the this. People are insulting others at a level that none of us have ever seen before, and it's become common. It's become ubiquitous with how things are done. I don't think that's who we are as Americans. I certainly don't think that's who we are as Mainers. The question becomes, will we put a stop to that? And will we allow that going forward? I will tell you, I'm very focused on a smart, progressive approach to grow our economy. And I think that a lot of these issues, people on both sides of the aisle agree that we have those challenges. The approach will be different. Mm-hmm. But sharing credit, bringing people together, these are some common threads that we need to see out of leadership. And sort of the backroom dealing or vilifying, whether it's the press or whether it's your opponents or you know, any of the stuff that's going on, it's just – I have no interest in doing that. I haven't spent my life positioning myself to run for one office or another. If things weren't the way they are in my mind in this state and in this country now, I probably wouldn't be running for governor. I've got a strong marriage. I've got great kids. I've got a good job. But I really do think we need new leaders right now stepping up.
You've been traveling the state for many months now, and I'm sure you've seen the conditions of the roads and the bridges. I'm sure you've read the reports about the deteriorating condition of that infrastructure. Lately, we've been on a path of bonding. Is that a sustainable path? And if not, how do you address these infrastructure needs?
Well, there are several different ways to fund transportation, and you're correct. We've got, I think it was a C-minus of the Association, Society of Civil Engineers. And you go on any back road, it's bad. The different funding mechanisms are bonding, you know, through tolls, gas tax. Those are kind of the top ones. I think that although you mentioned we have bonding, I would argue that we haven't had a very forward-looking, comprehensive approach to bonding. It seems ad hoc. It's whether it's Land for Maine's Future or transportation infrastructure or R&D. It's just, in my mind, it's because we haven't had the leadership that comes up with a 10-year plan, with a vision of what our state could look like, and comprehensively approach that. So I continue to think that bonding, but done in a different way, in a more comprehensive way, is the smart approach to that. The other options I would certainly look at, I've heard of some great ideas with respect to tolling, where they're looking at seasonal tolling that can perhaps focus more on getting some of that out-of-state tourists that are driving up to Maine, or allowing a type of system where you could get some recoupment as a Mainer based upon every time you go in to register your car each year, looking at how much mileage you had, et cetera, et cetera. It's sort of a backhanded way to tax higher the folks that are coming in from out of state. So I would be looking at all of those different options, but most importantly, I would be looking at the fact that we have to have, as I said, infrastructure is one of our top needs. I spoke mostly about broadband, but the roads, the logistical byways through the state are important.
Is a gas tax increase something that you would even consider?
I have not done the deep dive to sit here and say we're going to raise the gas tax. I know the different options on how to do it. I think in a state that has not a lot of disposable income, anytime we look at adjusting taxes for anything, whether it's income tax or whether it's a gas tax or other things, you have to look at those secondary, tertiary effects that come with it, or whether are we a bit underbonded right now and does it make more sense to do it that way. So I wouldn't be willing to commit to doing that over, you know, this interview. But would I look at it? Yeah, definitely.
What do you think are Maine's three greatest assets?
Our people, our brand, if you will, and our opportunities. And I will leave it at this. I have literally been around the world with the military, working overseas on energy issues through USAID. And I just think of the fact that there are 7 billion people in this world. And I think of being a kid when you spin the globe and pick little spots on the globe. We've got a great spot. We ought to be able to provide for ourselves. We ought to be able to grow our economy. There are parts of the world where they don't even have that opportunity because of the spot they're in. We've got an abundance of natural resources. We just need the vision and the leadership to have to grow and expand our economy. And I believe with the right leaders coming in, I would ask people to look closely at my candidacy. We can do it.
Adam Cody is one of 7 Democrats vying for a chance at the Blaine House this fall. He spoke with Maine Public's Steve Missler. Next, Ken Fredette is an attorney who was elected to the Maine House of Representatives in 2010. where he is currently serving his fourth term and was elected as the House Republican leader. Fredette earned a bachelor's degree from the University of Maine at Machias, a law degree from the University of Maine School of Law, and a master's from the Harvard Kennedy School. He told Steve Missler that what makes him stand out from the other Republicans in the race is his solid commitment to conservative values.
Two of them are recent welcome converts to the Republican Party, and I think that's an important distinction that this is something I've done for most of my life. So it's about that commitment to the true, real conservative Republican values that you're going to find in me and find in my history. I think my military background is something that I think that makes me different from them. But I think most importantly, it's the actual work that we've succeeded in doing in the legislature here over the last 8 years that it's really brought this economy to where we are today, $200 million in the rainy day fund and basically full employment. So I don't think anybody else can look at that track record and say that we've been there and done that.
What is the biggest challenge facing Maine, Ken, and what would you do as governor to respond to it?
There's no doubt that the opioid crisis is the biggest crisis facing Maine right now, and it's a lot of it is sort of underground, and it's sort of part of an undercurrent. And while we can measure, we had 418 opioid overdoses last year, a record in Maine, I suspect the number is actually much higher. And I think that it's a far bigger crisis than we realize. I think part of it is we have gangs that have moved into Maine, particularly in the cities, and that there's some real underground crime being associated with this. And as governor, it would be my top priority. We have prevention and treatment, but the first thing and my highest priority would be enforcement. I like to joke that we'd build a wall at the Kittery Bridge and put a police officer checking every car coming in. We won't go that far, but making sure that enforcement, that those drugs that are coming into Maine are going to be stopped and the people that are doing it are going to go to jail.
Obviously, that the idea of an enforcement approach, that's something that Governor LePage has pursued. And the criticism of that is that you might be able to stem the supply, but you're not going to help the people that have already become addicted.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a mutually exclusive approach. I mean, I think it's a question of prevention and treatment are critical, I think, particularly in our K-12 schools. And look, I went down and visited the Hub and Spoke program down at the Biddeford Medical Facility down there where that's being done. I think that needs to be replicated, taken to scale throughout the state. But most importantly, I think if you're going to keep people or people not having access to drugs in an open, free way, keeps them from getting hooked to drugs in the first place. And we really have people that know how to do this, bring the drugs into Maine, get people to experiment with them, and then once they're hooked, they're hooked.
Polls continue to show that jobs are the biggest concerns for voters in Maine. What would you do as governor to help grow the economy?
Well, look, I mean, I think what we realize is back in 2010 when we had the Great Recession and we were at 8.5-9% unemployment, and we probably had lots of people that weren't even being counted in that had given up looking for jobs, that today we have virtual full employment, where basically we have jobs even in rural Maine where we have help wanted signs where there used to be, you know, foreclosure signs. And so I think it's a real difference and it's a real measure of how far we've come. I think that we have farther to go. And I think one of the reasons why we have to do that is because it helps to rise incomes, because we don't want to just sort of have jobs that are sort of, $10 an hour, $12 an hour jobs. You want it to be real good jobs. And the more competition there is for people, you're going to have better jobs with better benefits.
So as you know, Maine voters will be using ranked choice voting in this primary election. Assuming that you will rank yourself as the top choice, how are you going to rank your opponents?
This has actually been asked in other debates, and I think it's sort of an unfair question, because I don't think that it's fair to sort of try to suggest who else might be out there as your second choice or third choice. My answer to that always is any of the four Republicans are a better choice than the Democrats, because I think that they'll simply take us backwards and undo a lot of the work that we've done over the last 8 years.
So nationally, Maine ranks relatively low in its rate of gun violence, but nearly half of domestic violence homicide in the state involve guns. Should Maine's gun laws be changed to address that problem, or is there a different remedy?
Well, look, it's a real tragedy in Maine in regards to the domestic violence deaths related. You know, of course, we had that killing up in Dexter, Maine, where we had the two children and then the wife who had been killed by someone who had a protection order against him. I think that we can do more in regards to those protection orders. And you know, you may recall that I brought the bill forward about using the ankle bracelets to be able to actually track where If someone has a protection order against someone, and you can actually track them, much in a satellite, like even using your cell phone, people can identify where you are and if you're in that vicinity of those people. I don't think the answer is taking guns from law-abiding citizens who in Maine have shown a real responsible use of guns, a proud hunting tradition and whatnot. So I'm not in favor of that, but I do think that we need to make sure that in regards to anything like a domestic violence situation or people obviously that have mental health issues don't have access to guns.
I'm not sure where you came down on Senator Dion's red flag bill, which, to remind listeners, is a bill that would allow people to petition a court if they find that a spouse or a loved one or anyone really could be a danger to themselves or others and potentially confiscate their gun. Is that – you weren't supportive of that. Is that right?
Well, no. And I think part of the issue was that was brought in sort of, you know, middle of the way through the second session of the legislature where you really don't get a time to properly vet or go through a bill and to see what the implications are. I think the bigger issue here is that if people have – a mental disease or whatnot, you don't want to have those people to have guns. And oftentimes, you know, when they do a background check, they're supposed to indicate if, in fact, they have those sorts of issues. And, you know, I guess the issue might be, are there periods where some people may have a mental disease for a short period of time or a longer period of time? But again, I don't see where we want to take guns from law-abiding gun owners. And I think this bill is just sort of not quite ready for prime time in Maine, and it's not something that I'd support at this time.
You mentioned earlier that Maine is currently enjoying a historically low unemployment rate, but it ranks 44th nationally in median household income, which you also alluded to. How can we get Maine workers to earn more money?
Well, and I think the other piece that you need to bring in there, Steve, is that Maine also ranks third in tax burden in the country. And so what you really do is if you take that 43rd in income and then add a very high tax burden, it really means that people have less money to spend. And what that does is it affects quality of life for people that have to buy certain things, particularly if you have a family of, you know, two or three, four children. I mean, it just gets exponentially more expensive. So the way to change that over time is to create more job opportunities. And what that means is to have more employers come into Maine. Because as we have more employers and the competition is basic economics, more competition for skilled workers or blue-collar workers or whatever they might be, it's inevitably going to drive up people that are going to have to offer higher wages or maybe benefits to folks, such as health insurance. And so you can't do that until you've fixed many of the problems that we fixed over the last 8 years. I think we're well-positioned now to really move Maine into the next level of this, which is really – is we know we have a workforce shortage, but now how do we take that to mean not only jobs but better paying, higher paying jobs with better benefits?
So what you're saying is there might be a way to parlay our workforce shortage into a situation where we're not only just filling those jobs, but those jobs would be paying more.
Yeah, I mean it's it's the basic definition of economics. I mean your x-axis and your y-axis, demand versus supply, and eventually as the supply goes down, something has to push up, you know, demand, and so inevitably you have to come back into equilibrium. Equilibrium is going to be when you provide higher pay, better benefits, and what that means is you're going to either be keeping more people in Maine, so we don't have young people leaving Maine. Or we have people coming to Maine because they have competitive salaries and the great quality of life that we actually live here in Maine.
Maine is one of the more expensive states for electricity customers, although it's the lowest in New England. As governor, how important is it to you to lower power costs?
Well, I mean, and not only in terms of energy, but I mean, even groceries. I mean, if we are one of the highest states in the New England in the country to be able to go to the supermarket and buy food. So again, I mean, that's another issue about, you know, keeping people here in Maine. But look, energy is not an issue that Maine is going to solve on its own. We are a net exporter of energy. And so what we are really stuck with is Massachusetts dictating what is going to be the energy component here in New England. And so I'm real concerned, for example, nuclear power. Now, I'm not advocating nuclear power per se, but it is a very inexpensive way to generate electricity. And that's a very different electricity source than coal. Mm-hmm. which is, you know, very polluting. It's you know, all of those other issues that, that compete with that. You know, we're forcing nuclear power offline. And part of that is why the, we are talking to Quebec, and Boston's talking to Quebec about bringing down hydropower, because as those energy sources go offline, if we don't replace them, when are we going to start talking about rolling blackouts for electricity? So it's a regional problem. And as you know, Steve, I co-authored the omnibus energy bill with two Democrats of the chairs of the Energy Committee, Senator Cleveland and Representative Hobbins, where we actually talked about, in a regional approach, expanding gas line capacity coming into New England so that when we have that high demand for electricity, we essentially have the capacity to deal with it and not force prices up. And it's, again, it's a basic economics issue.
When you mentioned earlier that Massachusetts is dictating policy, you're referencing the natural gas pipeline. Am I right? Is that
That's
what you're
correct.
Talking about?
Yep. Yep. And well, not only that, but also now their RFP, which is really a bid for additional electricity now coming down from Canada. I mean, Quebec is going to get power down to Boston. Now, it's a question of, is it going to go through Vermont, Maine, or New Hampshire? But it's going to get there one way or the other, because there's criteria that Massachusetts has set for this. And look, part of that is going to be in the out years, offshore wind, for example. And again, I mean, I'm not an advocate necessarily for offshore wind, but that's going to be a component of this conversation in the out years that we need to recognize.
A lot has been made over the years about attracting businesses to the state of Maine, and some believe that tax incentives are one way to do that. Not tax cuts, which you've been talking about before, but tax incentives for businesses such as Pine Tree Zones. Do you see those programs as effective economic development tools or as corporate welfare, as some describe them?
Well, look, as governor, one of the first things that I would propose doing in the first budget that I would submit would be really totally revamping the Department of Economic and Community Development, probably renaming it the Department of Innovation and Growth, so that we can really look in a much broader way at how can we attract and keep those businesses to Maine. I was a co-sponsor of the bill, for example, that allowed for IDEX. I mean, they were looking for simply a little recognition from Maine in terms of headquartering. It's, you know, 500-person business right here in Maine. It was a bill that we finally got through the taxation committee, and it was really a small price to pay for the wide expansion IDEX was going to do in Westbrook. There, most recently, we had the Bath Iron Works shipyard builder credit that we also did there. And again, you know, the competitor for Bath Iron Works is Ingalls, which is in a southern state where the electricity is cheaper. They're far more subsidized from their state government. We need to be able to work with them to keep those businesses here and to have them be competitive, because, look, at the end of the day, companies are looking at the bottom line, and if they have a way to make more profit on their investments somewhere else, they're likely to go there.
The other side of that is that what are the protections that Maine taxpayers are getting a return on the investment? Are those companies paying good enough wages? Are there enough protections in these programs to ensure that, in your view?
Yeah. The BIW, the Bath Iron Works Shipbuilder Bill, I think had some very good measures in there in terms of job creation and how many more jobs are you going to add. Capital investments that you need to make in order to be entitled to the credit. And so I think that that bill was actually a bill that was much improved in terms of making sure that we have proper metrics in there so that we're able to measure, was this a good investment for taxpayer money? Because we shouldn't just be giving money away for the sake of giving money away. There needs to be measurable metrics to hold them accountable and to hold taxpayers and the people here, in terms of using and seeing those taxpayer dollars, that they're being used wisely.
As you know, there's been a lot of changes made to Maine's welfare system over the last 7.5 years. There have been very contentious changes, hard-fought battles in the legislature over these, and there have certainly been campaigns waged for and against those changes. What is the status of Maine's welfare and social safety net program, in your view? Is it working? Are the anti-poverty programs actually lifting people out of poverty, or do we need to make some more changes?
Well, I mean, part of this is the question about priorities. And I think what I mean by that is that, you know, we have people in Maine who are severely disabled, either physically or mentally. And the question is, are you taking care of those people who would be the most vulnerable people? Are you taking care of those people versus are you taking care of able-bodied people that are able to work and to go out and do things in their communities? I think often in the past, over the last three or four decades, you know, we've really ignored the most vulnerable and had this welfare system, which has really created an incentive for people to stay on welfare because, you know, if they went out and got a job, they'd lose their benefits or they might lose their Medicaid insurance. It's just a disincentive to the sort of the perverse system where you should have an incentive to get up in the morning, go get a job. And look, we have to recognize there are people in Maine that are vulnerable, that are in desperate situations. And that's why you have a safety net. And I think it's there. I think that it's important. It needs to be maintained. But again, I think that there have to be metrics to make sure that we're measuring that the use of our taxpayer dollars are taken care of. Those that need it, that are properly using it, that there's no fraud in it, and that it's not people that otherwise have the opportunity to go to work or could otherwise get a job and simply choose to keep getting taxpayer benefits.
Voters overwhelmingly approved expanding Medicaid at the polls last year, yet the legislature's been at odds about how to fund the state's share of expanding that program. If elected, would you attempt to appeal that voter-approved law, or would you try to find a way to implement it?
Well, look, first and foremost, you can't repeal the law unless you have the votes. And if we don't have the votes, then you actually we're a nation of laws and not of men. And what I mean by that is if the law is the law, you have to figure out how you're going to do it. Now, what I would suggest is what we've done, for example, with the marijuana law that was passed by voters. It's a very different law today than what was passed by the voters at the polls. Now, what I would suggest is if we can't repeal the law, I think that Medicaid expansion is going to have to be something that's going to have to be amended. Mm-hmm. It's going to have to be changed because we're going to have to look at, you know, what's its sustainability, not only in 6 months, but 2 years out, 5 years out. We know, for example, that there's a questions of how much does it get used at the hospitals, how many people are on it. There's what are the cost factors of people going to the hospital? All kinds of variables in there. And what I mean by variables, things that can go up and go down that may drive the cost in that program, we need it to be sustainable. And so I think what Democrats don't really want to address is that question of sustainability, because what sustainability means that you need to put guideposts on it. And I would, and for example, if I'm governor, what I would require is that there needs to be certain triggers within the legislation that says, you know, if we hit a recession and we lose revenues $200-$400 million, there's going to be a natural sort of drawdown in that program so that, you know, we're not having to cannibalize the Department of Education or the Department of Agriculture to pay for people on Medicaid. And so I think there's a way to do it if we have to do it, but it's going to look different than what it looks like that was passed at the polls.
If you did have the votes to repeal it, is that something that you would pursue?
Well, I think that the Republicans have sort of run on that theory that they don't support Medicaid expansion. And so if we come back in session and Republicans are in the majority and they wanted to repeal it, I suspect that that's what we would do if we had the votes. Reality is we may not have the votes, and if we don't, you then have to look at implementing the law.
Does the state pay its fair share of local education costs? And if not, how much more should it cover, and how should we fund it?
Well, look, I think the state pays beyond its fair share of the education cost. And you know, we're really chasing the tail of the dog here, because what we know as a fact is, for example, the cost, for example, for special education, those kids that need additional services beyond the normal teacher in the classroom, continues to skyrocket throughout the state. But I would also suggest that that's even more pronounced sometimes in the rural districts. And so that when you have a school district with, you know, 200 kids in it, and, you know, 50 of those kids are special ed kids, there's a disproportional cost in that school district to take and provide those additional services for those kids on special ed. So we need to look at, again, a sustainable way to be able to pay for education K-12, including special ed, but not to continue to have this burden and this expectation that the state is going to essentially write a blank check to local school districts that sometimes want to continue to provide all the services, everything that can be done from A to Z, and say, well, you know, you need to give us the money. And because we just can't afford to do that. Everybody has a household, and everybody might like to have, you know, the best food and the best cars to drive, but you also have a budget, and you need to make decisions within that budget.
Maine is experiencing a teacher shortage. How would you incent more Mainers to consider a career in teaching?
Well, I think one of the things you have to do, and one of the things that we've seen here in Maine is that our public universities, many of which have education, teacher education programs for people to become teachers, is to, in some ways, we've kept that tuition down. I think particularly for rural Maine, we could have some loan forgiveness programs that, for example, you know, where I grew up in rural Washington County, if someone wants to go up there and teach, you do some loan forgiveness for them. But you know, you have to look at the issue of teacher pay. You know, as we continue to drive up the minimum wage, you know, even the issue of what's the entry pay for a teacher is becomes a real issue. And I'm not advocating that we pay teachers more money. But again, I think all of these driving cost driving factors that we need to look at. But look, it's an honorable profession. Teachers made a change in my life, whether I was in kindergarten or a freshman in college. It's a great, noble profession, and we need to continue to encourage that because they're training the next leaders for the state down the road.
Do you think Maine's referendum process is working as intended?
Well, I don't think I've found anybody in Maine that thinks that it's working as intended except for the Maine People's Alliance. You know, I mean, they've essentially become the appropriations committee for the state of Maine. You know and I know that you can go out and collect 60,000 signatures. Look, you know and I know that they're paying people to collect signatures. A lot of this money is what we call dark money. It's coming from out of state. There's not transparency on how it's paid for. And Maine is a cheap date. And what I mean by that is they can come into Maine and spend $1 million, $1.5 million, get a pretty significant policy change done, and then they then go to these bigger states and say, hey, look what happened in Maine. We need now to do this in New York or Colorado or Indiana. And so, you know, the system is being abused right now. But look, we've had bills in the legislature to change it. Democrats refuse to change it. And I think that eventually Maine could pay a significant price for not being willing to do that.
So there's a working theory that the country is so polarized that it's best for elected officials to keep their supporters happy and loyal rather than agree to compromise or build coalitions that could alienate the people that helped put them in office. Do you believe that theory is true? And if so, what should be done about it?
Well, you know, I think our country was really built on this question of debate and democracy. And, you know, sometimes it's just messy, you know. I was a very young kid, and I don't really remember it, but, you know, in the late 60s, you know, we had the Vietnam War raging on, and it was a, you know, it was a big deal from everything that I read about it, and I watched video clips on what was going on back then. And so, I mean, there are going to be periods of time in our history where we have these periods of uneasiness, but we work through them. And sometimes, unfortunately, it takes, you know, years to work through that, and I think we've kind of gone through a period now where we're doing that. You know, unfortunately, I'm old enough to remember Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan actually working together to bring the country out of a great recession, which really transformed the country for a generation. And I think both parties can take credit for that. And so we're going to have periods of time where we will have division and debate, and then other times where people work more together to make a pretty significant change.
Candidates for governor often talk about transparency in government. How important is it for people to know what their government is up to?
Well, look, I think one of the things that I would do as governor is that I would probably have a weekly press conference. You know, sit down with the media, have them ask questions. You know, where are we going? What are we doing with this? Why are you doing that, Ken? And I think it's important to have that transparency and that dialogue with the media so that they understand where you're going. Look, for me, it's going to be about talking about my conservative values, about why we want to take Maine in a certain direction. And, you know, driving leadership is a difficult thing to do. And you can't simply say, let's go there and expect people to follow. You need to explain to people why we should go there, why it's better for the Maine people, and why that vision is more important in terms of going in a different direction. And so I think part of that is about having a conversation with the Maine people.
Beyond signing bills into law, how can the governor improve the lives of Mainers?
Well, I think it's just about being out in the state. And I mean, that's from Kittery to Allagash and Calais to Jackman. And all those places in Maine are different. They're beautiful. You know, Maine, I oftentimes feel like has seven different Maines within it that are all very different. We know that York County and Aroostook County are very different. The coast is different than the Jackman area. And so When you're doing policy in Augusta, I think oftentimes it's difficult to understand that when we're passing policy, it might not be the best thing for people in Aroostook County, but maybe it is in York County. So I think when you're looking at legislation as a governor and policies, it's got to be policies that's going to work for most everyone within the state.
Maine has received failing grades for the condition of its infrastructure, and it currently has a backlog of deferred maintenance for roads and bridges. Yet bipartisan proposals to deal with the funding problem haven't really gone anywhere in over the years. And the solution has been to ask voters to borrow for transportation bonds. Is that sustainable? And if not, what's the alternative to bonding?
Well, it's not sustainable. And, one of the things, if I'm elected governor, that I want to be remembered for is being the infrastructure governor. Because I think now where we put Maine people back to work, we now need to start looking at the question of our infrastructure. And that doesn't just mean roads and bridges. It's roads and bridges. It's broadband. It's our hospitals. It's all of those things. It's our schools. It's all those things sort of that are the very basic needs that we need to have a robust economy. But look, I mean, the reality is when I was a kid in the small town of Danforth growing up, you could have a child in Holton, Maine. You could go to Callis and have a baby. You could go to Lincoln and have a baby. And those were all about an hour drive. None of those places now have the infrastructure so that if you're living in Danforth, you can go to one of those hospitals and deliver a baby. That's a real problem. And so how do we look at that in a more global way? Because the consequence of that is that oftentimes you may not mean it or it's an intended consequence, but you're driving people out of rural Maine. And I don't think it's any different for people that are retired who want to be close to a hospital in case they need hospital services. And so we need to make sure we have an infrastructure and how it's paid for. And I think it can be achieved by realigning priorities within existing resources of the state budget. And it has to be something that you work and put forward as a conservative plan, but with Democrats having some input on what are the priorities for that.
What are Maine's three greatest assets, and how would you best leverage those to improve Mainer's economy?
Well, look, Maine's biggest asset's always been its people. I mean, the great people that we have here in the state of Maine. The second greatest assets is our natural resources. It's our coastlines, the trees, our mountains, clean water. The third of all is it's just our quality of life in general. It really can't be matched in any other state in this country. I think we're positioned to really take Maine to the next level. I think our full employment is going to give us the foundation to do that. It's truly foundational to be able to take us to the next level. And if we can capitalize in this next 4 years on that, I think we're going to see Maine in a very different place. And that's why I want to be governor of the state of Maine, is to really take us to that next level.
Ken Fredette, one of four Republicans in this year's primary race for governor. He spoke with Maine Public's Steve Missler. If you missed either of our candidate interviews in this past hour, you can hear all 14 conversations at mainpublic.org/yourvote. You can also learn more about each of the candidates and see their positions broken down on an easy-to-use issues grid near the top of our Your Vote page. I'm Keith Shortall. Thanks for listening.